So we're joined in the studio today by Professor Stephanie Ross and Professor Larry Savage, and we're going to be looking into these two very interesting academics in the book that is just coming out now. I should announce that it is a book launch. Of course, you can attend that today at 7 o'clock p.m., and the book is entitled Rethinking the Politics of Labor in Canada, and it's a public event, and it's going to be at the Workers' Arts and Heritage Center at 51 Stewart Street in Hamilton right here, and again, that's 7 o'clock p.m. So joining us right here, actually physically in the studio, is Stephanie Ross, assistant professor and coordinator of the Work and Labor Studies program in the Department of Social Science at York University, and also Larry Savage, associate professor of political science and labor studies at Brock University. Thank you both so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. We're really glad to be here.
It's great for our listeners to have people live in the studio. They can hear you so much better. And I think that's very important because, you know, there's been a lot of developments in labor studies and research, political science fields in terms of labor relations, union renewal, a whole bunch of subjects. And I think you have helpfully assembled a lot of that thinking. You have edited this book and it's put together the works of a number of academics familiar to people in Hamilton, right here at McMaster, as well as York, Brock, and other universities. So very thankful for this. I think there's a few main themes in the book, and I've tried to discern them from my reading of the book. And union renewal is clearly one of those things. When we think of what a union is and what it does, there's certain things that come to mind. Strikes, bargaining campaigns, bargaining units, organizing drives, and so on. But unions have not always operated like that, I don't think, because we're in a very historically specific period where unions operate in a very specific manner. So before that, unions had to operate differently if they could operate at all. Now I think we can start making comparisons between the past and the present.
For sure. I mean, I think one of the things that our book tries to do is tries to understand the basis on which workers were able to establish certain kinds of power in the 20th century. What were the ways in which workers organized, both in the workplace and in the broader community, that allowed them to have economic, political, social, and cultural power? None of us in that contributed to the book think that workers were ever in a position of preeminence in our society. I think we all agree that there's no doubt that workers were able to establish a certain level of influence over their own working conditions, as well as over the social policies that are fundamental to not only workers' interests, but a more equitable society. And since the 1970s onward, the union movement in particular, their capacity economically and politically to have influence, to have a capacity to shape the policies of the broader society, has been on the wane. And so this book really is about trying to take stock of what that form of unionism was that at a certain moment in time was able to have power, what happened from the 1970s on that both outside of the labor movement in sort of broader political economic processes, but also inside the movement itself, that led to its waning, and what is it now that it's faced with, in some ways, enemies at every corner? What is now possible for the labor movement, understood very broadly, to do to regain that power, perhaps in new forms with new strategies? And so our book is an attempt to analyze those problems and make a contribution to thinking about how to reestablish that power.
Absolutely. And in terms of the 1970s, that's a very important decade for labor, I think, because that's when the gains stopped, in a sense. There was a policy of gradual improvement, and there was the economic crisis and other factors. Around 73, 74, the mid-70s, that was the height of the minimum wage in the United States, for example. And it's been stagnant or downhill since that time. So the family earnings, for example, they've declined at the same time as union power has. There's very real correlation, I think. So there's that aspect to look at. Certainly there's been a campaign among employers together with governments, and increasingly this has been called neoliberalism, and it's the restructuring of the economy in certain ways to emphasize competition between countries and between workers in the same country, for example, as well as just relentless accumulation. And it seems that at this time when the very wealthy are increasing their share of wealth, the blames for the economic problems are sometimes attributed to unions, especially by the media, the corporate press, and so on. So in a sense, they've succeeded in pitting workers against one another, unionized workers against non-unionized workers, public sector versus private sector. I understand that's been a continuing concern for researchers involved in union renewal.
Yeah. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. One of the central preoccupations of the book is this idea of reverse class resentment, which was a term coined by Thomas Walkham a couple years ago in a column he did in the Toronto Star, that essentially talks about this idea that, you know, in years gone by, certainly in the dirty 30s, that when we thought about class resentment, we thought about working class people resenting these silk-hatted capitalists who had excesses of money, and they thought, well, you know, why could this person have all sorts of money and I'm just struggling to get by? But this new contemporary reverse class resentment pits working class people against one another. And so if you work this very same occupation as your neighbor, but they happen to be unionized and through collective bargaining have achieved benefits or a pension, and the non-union counterpart, the other neighbor, says to them, well, if I can't have a pension and if I can't have benefits at my non-union job, you shouldn't have them either. And that idea of reverse class resentment, I think, is the central problem that unions in Canada are facing today. How do they reverse this trend? How do they deflect that criticism so that it's pointed at its proper targets, the neoliberal governments and certainly the big businesses that are driving this agenda?
And I should add to that that, you know, as I said before, one of the aspects of decline of labor movement's power has been both material and ideological. And I think what Larry's just described is partly the ideological context, right, that our ideas about who has power have changed. And that has been in part a product of a very concerted attempt on the part of those who have real power in our society to change our ways of thinking about that. But there is also a material aspect to this that allows for people who don't haven't had access to the kinds of power that unionization has allowed for certain groups of workers in Canada, at most 30 to 35% ever, peaking at the end of the 1980s. That for those people, there's a material who have been outside of the labor movement, officially speaking, there is a real aspect to their experience that is fertile ground for this ideological sleight of hand. And that is that there is something called the union advantage, that unionized workers do enjoy higher wages, access to benefits, a range of things that non-union workers don't have. And so in terms of the material, and that gap has widened. Yeah. And in terms of then the way in which those messages fall on infertile ground, this is a real strategic problem for the labor movement today, to address that growing real inequality within the working class. So inequality is a problem in our society in general, and we've talked a lot about in the last year about the 1% versus the 99%. And that's a useful language to identify the fact that there's a very small number of people in our society who have real power. At the same time, there are really important divisions within the 99% that matter and that people see and experience every day. And unless and until the labor movement is able to challenge those inequalities within the working class, it's going to be very difficult for them to recapture economic or political traction in our society.
And certainly, again, underlying that battle of ideas that's going on, there is this material reality, this economic situation where people feel like there's just less to go around, and therefore they've got to be pitted against one another in a zero-sum game. I think that underlies a lot of the resentment. And certainly in terms of the divisions among the 99%, the authors of Rethinking the Politics of Labor in Canada are going to be very aware of what those differences are, very aware of the different struggles. So when we talk about 1% and 99%, we know there's various gradations and things we're talking about, and we have a panel of people that are quite capable of discussing that. We certainly are in a new economic reality. In the media, there's an overused term, the new normal, for example, which is beaten into our heads, and we all have a sense of what that means. For different people, it can mean more hours, it can mean unpaid work. even though you're supposed to be paid for it. It can mean all sorts of things, and that's the new normal for so many people. We had enjoyed a period of prosperity and high unionization after the Second World War, and there were some segments of the population that benefited from participation in very stable unions. And those unions have been under threat now for the last 20 or more years. There was always a group of people that did not have stable unions, or they did not have official, formally constituted unions. And these were often immigrant communities, women, visible minorities, other people that were on the periphery of the labor market. But they sometimes were able to innovate strategies that serve their economic interests in a time of great precariousness for them, because they could never be assured of stable work. And so they innovated some methods. I know that the book looks to some degree at community unionism and social unionism. And I think community unionism in particular was developed to meet people who could not be counted on having a stable employment relationship. Can you tell me how that works roughly?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, community unionism as a particular form of union strategy has a long history, even though we didn't always call it that. That term was coined in the 1960s in the United States to describe the kind of organizing that that people were doing in parts of the of urban environments where deindustrialization had happened, particularly in the Black communities, and there were larger and growing segments of the working class in American cities were being thrown out of unionizable work. And so with the growth of unemployment, underemployment, a sort of a cycling between jobs and perhaps being on social welfare, et cetera, there was a group of people who raised the question of whether or not it is ever going to be possible to unionize elements of the working class whose material experience was basically being made surplus to the main economy, whether they would ever be able to be represented in the traditional union form where you have stable membership, you have regular collective bargaining, you have a regularized relationship that's sort of backed up by law between a union and a particular employer. And so community unionism, this idea that that, you know, using community organizing strategies, you could actually get working class people together to fight on issues that were not necessarily employment related or directly employment related, but were certainly fundamental to their experience of class inequality and their economic well-being. So a lot of community unionism and community organizing happened in the intersection between employment, where people live, so neighborhoods and in neighborhood issues, as well as organizing around to put pressure on the state, the government, to improve the benefits that people received through various forms of social assistance. And so it was sort of using a class framework to organize people around economic issues, but not necessarily in particular workplaces, but across workplaces. So in the contemporary context, we see, for instance, campaigns for a living wage in particular communities, which bring together coalitions of people, whether they're, you know, in the union movement, in faith communities, in groups of workers who are working poor or marginalized or excluded from the labor market altogether, in, you know, coalitions to improve the minimum wage the wage that prevails in a particular city, and that by exerting directly political power over municipal officials or state or provincial officials, rather than trying to organize in a particular workplace and raise the wages of a particular group of workers, community unionism seeks to generalize improvements to segments of the working class that are not located in a particular workplace. We see lots of other examples like that in Canada too right now. The Workers Action Centre movement, or the Workers Centre movement, of which the Workers Action Centre in Toronto is a primary example, attempts to organize workers who don't have union protection but who are experiencing violations of their legal rights under the Employment Standards Act, which is a huge problem, yes, as we know in our province and in the country in general. People assume that because there's laws that they're enforced, that you, if you have a minimum wage law, that it's actually enforced, but we know that's actually not true. And so workers' action centers have emerged to organize workers not to collectively bargain or to seek a union certification, but to act collectively to pressure their employers, sometimes using shame, to pressure their employers to actually live up to their legal responsibilities. And so there's a lot of interesting things going on outside of the framework of established or formal unions that are highlighted in our book, in various chapters of our book, whether it's in Simon Black's chapter on community unionism or Aziz Chowdhury and Mark Thomas, their chapter on migrant worker organizing in Ontario and Quebec. There's a lot of interesting things going on that point to the revival of community unionism.
Yeah. I mean, just to add to that, I think one of the benefits of this strategy is that it's not bound by labor law frameworks in the way that we think of traditional union management relations. And so there are some pretty innovative and radical things that workers through these worker centers or their own community organizations can do that unions themselves would be very uncomfortable tackling. And I think that that's certainly highlighted in the chapters that Stephanie's talked about. I think Kendra Coulter writes a chapter on anti-poverty organizing that is also steeped in notions of community unionism. And then Charles Smith writes a chapter on labor and the law where he talks about this issue of how the law expands our opportunities to do things, but it also constrains us at the same time. And I think community unionism lies at the center of that debate.
Yes, you have organizations like the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, and I think it might have been Peter Grafe's article where he was looking at Quebec, and he said sometimes it seems like Quebec has 100 OCAPs in terms of its organizing, which helps explain some of the things going on. Certainly the role of government is very important at times, and we're going to get into that a bit more, Larry, because I know you've been looking at that. In terms of the community organizing, Stephanie, you mentioned the radical possibilities, and certainly in the 60s, I think Simon Black in the past has mentioned Cesar Chavez as a person who innovated some of those strategies, because the idea here, and I get how it works from what you're saying, is that there's people that live in a certain area, a certain geographic location, but their jobs change. They have a job, mm-hmm. and then they're out of a job, and as you said, they've been surplused. So you sometimes want to organize people based on where they are physically rather than the job, because they're not in that long permanent job relationship. And we're living in a time now where so many of us feel surplus to requirements. So
exactly. And I mean, I think that, you know, this speaks to one of the crucial questions that the labor movement faces today in terms of its ability to reestablish its power and its capacity to speak on behalf of the working class in Canada, which is really this question of who does the labor movement represent? Who is it that is considered within the boundaries of the labor movement and therefore to be struggled on behalf of and, you know, resources and put behind in order to meet their interests. And so we've been talking about the particular way in which in the 20th century the labor movement was institutionalized as a result of a massive upsurge of organizing, of political pressure, of massive strikes in the 1940s that actually led to the creation of really important parts of our legal framework, many of which have been under great pressure over the last several years, as we've seen the Harper government, for instance, use back-to-work legislation in a preemptive way, in a way to basically extinguish the right to strike at the federal level for all intents and purposes. So there was a massive, you know, it's important to note, there was a massive amount of economic and political pressure that led to what was widely considered throughout the labor movement as a victory of institutionalizing unions as legitimate institutions in our society, that when a majority of workers in a particular workplace voted for a union, the employer had to recognize it, to bargain with that union as the legitimate representative of those workers. And that was the basis on which, as you said, the gradual improvement of working class living standards was made possible. But there are, you know, even though you know, we don't want to toss that whole framework out. There are real consequences to that framework in terms of how union activity was shaped and who the union movement, which is, I would say, and I think we tried to argue this in the book, a subset of what we would consider the broader labor movement. The union movement's orientation has been to primarily represent the dues-paying membership of certified unions. And even though it has attempted to speak in the broader register of, you know, we represent everyone, when push comes to shove, the lion's share of the union movement's resources goes to collective bargaining, grievance handling, you know, dealing with the labor management relationship that only really speaks materially to the interests of their members. And so this raises a crucial question. How can then the labor movement, given that its orientation has been so shaped by the engagement with the law and the legal certification process, the grievance procedure, and that the notion of who is part of the labor movement has been shaped by that, how can the labor movement expand beyond that and encompass parts of the working class that not only need economic and political power, but they need forms to achieve that are not going to look like the union forms that were established in the 20th century. And it's really hard, I think, it's very challenging for the established union movement to really innovate structurally, even though we do see some signs that as the pressure mounts economically, politically, that there are some unions who are trying to find a way to really answer this question. Whether or not they'll be able to do it is still an open question.
Yeah, and I think this is the reason we put the book together, because we want to open up a discussion and contribute in the way that we can to this debate, because it's clear what the trajectory looks like. Unions are on the decline, business is getting stronger, the growing gap between the wealthy and the rest of us continues to grow, and unions need to be at the forefront of rethinking their strategies, because if they don't, they'll be wiped out. Yesterday we saw Governor Scott Walker survive a recall attempt in Wisconsin, and that was a pivotal battle in American labor history. The fact that he maintained his position in the face of massive uprisings of public sector workers and allies throughout the country. Now, mind you, you know, the Republicans outspent the Democrats 16-1, I think it was. But still, the right in the United States will be emboldened by this victory. Their cousins north of the border will certainly be emboldened by this victory. And unions have to be prepared for this fight, because it's coming right to their doorstep.
And again, this is where the political dimension becomes very important, and the relationships between unions and political parties. The Democrats perhaps could have fought harder in Wisconsin. There's a debate about that. I think it was right in the introduction, both of you mentioned that it seems as if governments don't have to be as responsive to labor and mass protests as they used to be. And there have been a lot of mass protests by unions and social movements in the last 30 years, fighting these developments, fighting neoliberalism, fighting wars, fighting tuition hikes, and all sorts of things. On occasion, there's been things that appear as successes. Some legislation or efforts to enact legislation have been reversed. Chrétien decided not to go into the Iraq War. There's been debates over effectiveness of various protests, but at other times it seems you can protest all you want and nothing happens, and that's very, very disheartening. And a lot of those protests in the 80s and 90s were to hold on to what people already had against governments like the Mike Harris government and other governments in Canada. And we take for granted the whole union relationship, the collective bargaining relationship you described, which, as you pointed out, it's a double-edged sword. It creates a framework from which we can all benefit, but it also can confine the activities of unions. But unions, having that as opposed to nothing, wanted to preserve those post-war gains. And it's not been easy. And a lot of what was thought to be permanent improvements in our society have shown themselves not to be permanent. Mm-hmm. Healthcare is under threat. Free education, that debate in Quebec is still going on, and tuitions continue to rise here. There's a whole bunch of other issues in terms of poverty, welfare, childcare, and so on. So a lot of achievements have been scaled back. And I guess when there has been protests, it's sometimes more difficult to institutionalize the gains. You have looked at the Days of Action, I know, and big protests, somewhat successful, but where do you go from that point? So the relationship between labor and political parties, the political sphere, the political spectrum, is very important. Larry, I know you've investigated strategic voting. This is partly tied to that strategy of gradualism, I think, because, again, people want to preserve the gains that they have, and they know that the provincial conservative or federal conservative governments, for example, are going to try to scale back those gains. So the question is, what do you do? What can we do about this rollback? You know, Walmart rolls back prices and governments roll back all of these social improvements. So, you know, you can imagine the smiley face and the numbers going backwards, and that's what's happening. So what do we do about that? I know because of the horror that teachers and other groups in society experience from some of these governments, there have been the look at strategic voting and the enactment of that in Ontario, in Quebec, in federal politics in general. And you looked at it through at least two frameworks. First, does it work the way it's supposed to? And the other idea is, what does it mean for workers? In terms of it working, what do you think of the effectiveness of strategic voting campaigns?
Well, I think the record's shown that in Canada and Ontario in particular, that strategic voting has not been a very effective strategy for the labor movement. But before I go into the reasons why I think that's the case, let me just take a step back, because in the introduction there, you talked about extra-parliamentary activism and parliamentary activism on behalf of labor. And certainly labor's been involved in both, but I think one of the things we talk about in the book is that they're losing the war on both fronts. So in terms of extra-parliamentary activism, there's a sense that there are these bursts of activity and organizing, but there's no institutional framework to sustain them. And so they end up fizzling out, and there's no mechanism for there to be some permanent protest movement that can be effective. On the other hand, on the other pole, the parliamentary politics has its own limitations. We know that many unions have a strong relationship with the New Democratic Party in Canada, but we also know from several provincial experiences that that relationship is not always what it's cracked up to be in practice. Certainly there are still some bitter and disgruntled trade unionists in Ontario who curse Bob Rae's name. So we have to be clear about those limitations, and not only when those parties are in government and what they're able to deliver working class constituencies, but also when they're in opposition. And we may see this in Ontario right now, where we have an NDP caucus who abstained from a vote on what was essentially an austerity budget, and what that means for its relationship with the union movement, because we saw Sid Ryan, the president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, who very clearly opposed the party's decision to abstain from voting. And so it's not just a matter of having social democratic parties or pro-labour parties in government and what do they do for you, but what do they do for you outside of government too? So that said, strategic voting, I think, emerged as a strategy because the New Democratic Party was not seen as an effective vehicle to move working class interests forward in the same way that it was seen in previous decades. And we saw a big chunk of the labor movement decide that if we can't win government through the traditional parliamentary way of doing things, we might do the second best thing, which is to prevent the worst case scenario. And for the labor movement, that means blocking conservative governments, whether they're federal or provincial. The problems, as you've mentioned with this, are twofold. One is that if the strategy is completely defensive, and that means that unions then target their money in such a way and their organizers in such a way that's not to elect something positive, but rather to stop something negative, you know, we're choosing between lesser evils of neoliberalism in some cases. Because I don't think there's much ideological difference between liberal and conservative parties federally and provincially in Ontario. And so we sort of see an odd relationship between primarily teachers' unions, building and construction trade unions, most recently the Canadian Auto Workers Union, that's been a very big proponent of strategic voting. Surprising in many ways because it was one of the founding unions, founding partners of the New Democratic Party in the 1960s. What's interesting about it is that I think these unions, if they want a certain outcome, which, you know, they'll say officially is, you know, just not conservative, but a mix of liberal and New Democrat, and they'll support New Democrats where they can win. But otherwise, we pick the candidate who's best positioned to block the Tories. But that essentially means endorsing candidates who don't support the right for farm workers to unionize, for example. It means working to elect candidates who don't support an anti-scab law. It means supporting candidates who don't support card-based union certification. And I think the labor movement tying themselves to those public policy issues is very concerning because it shows the labor movement's lack of ability to think beyond a very narrow, defensive, self-interested kind of politics. And if we're not able to dream outside of what are, I think, some pretty fundamental union issues, it doesn't bode well for what message that sends to rank-and-file workers in general.
Well, and if I could just add, too, I think this is a really important issue around, like, what differences do elections and electoral politics make for the union movement and for the working class more generally? And, you know, I think that we're in a period where there are lots of signs that, even though, I mean, I want to say, and I think most of us who have contributed to this book want to say, you know, elections matter. It matters that Scott Walker was, you know, not recalled yesterday, right? There are important policy differences between different political parties. But the policy differences aren't as great as they used to be. And I think that, you know, to a large extent, what we're really faced with as a series of choices in the electoral arena is various versions of neoliberalism, right? Where the market is considered to be the central arbiter of good policy, and that, you know, we're basically choosing between, a undiluted version of neoliberalism, a very, you know, tough medicine to take, where the market determines almost everything about how our social resources are distributed and how people relate with each other, to neoliberalism light, where there's some attempt to mitigate or moderate the effects of the market on people's lives, but not fundamentally challenge that notion that it is the economy, quote unquote, or the market that is the center, and that we all exist to serve the market, right? And Brian Evans' chapter in our book, I think, is when, you know, many people who are advocates or partisans of the NDP read it, I think it will be very tough medicine in the sense that, or it will be very provocative in the sense that he argues that the NDP has, whether pragmatically or ideologically, accepted neoliberalism as the basic policy framework, even if it's not the most extreme version of neoliberalism that that Larry was talking about, the elements of the labor movement trying to block through strategic voting, that there's a way in which those who have economic power in our society have the capacity to trump or to block policies that people want and need to make a real difference in their lives, and that the political parties who we choose between, in some ways, accept that as the basis for governing. And this creates a major political problem, not just for the union movement, but for working class people in general. And I think it's part of the lack of participation in elections, the declining turnout, voter turnout that we've experienced in Canada, but in the United States as well, is, I'm going to go on a limb and say, a symptom of the sense that people have that there aren't any real choices in the political system. And so, you know, we're in a very difficult political moment then? If the forces of progressivism have to take stock, why are our electoral strategies not working? When they work, what kinds of governments or representatives do we get? And what kinds of policies do they actually advocate? And why, if they don't advocate for the policies that we actually want and need, why is that the case and how can we change that? And that also raises the question of, like, what's the relationship then between the attempt to elect progressive voices to Parliament and extra-parliamentary activity, protest movements that in some ways challenge the status quo and disrupt and try to push the boundaries of what is possible beyond the neoliberal consensus. And so our book is an attempt to try and contribute to that discussion and to raise that as a crucial issue for movements, the labor movement and other progressive social movements, to actually confront and sort out going forward, because it's really not an either-or proposition. It really is about how does the electoral strategy and the protest strategy articulate together, connect together, allow for each to be stronger.
That seems to be it. You have to fight these battles in the unions, in the political sphere, and on the streets, in the social movements. And voting-wise, you should be able to vote with your heart, whatever that means in your particular situation. And if your friend believes something and they've been getting off base, you got to help them out or think, what can you do?
It's not just about, you know, parties or working-class parties, labor-friendly parties sort of selling out the working class, which... Yeah. This wouldn't be an original contribution in that sense. I think what makes it interesting, though, is this idea that it's not only the social democratic parties who have internalized neoliberalism, but in many ways, unions themselves have begun to internalize some important pillars of neoliberalism and therefore, you know, throw up their hands to say, or put themselves in a box, or they continue on the path that they're most familiar with because they have a strategic paralysis. And hopefully, you know, we can push a panic button and get people talking. I mean, so those two ends of the book, I think, are covered. We have chapters on sort of institutional, traditional labor politics. Peter Grafe writes a great chapter on Quebec labor. Dennis Pilon writes an article on electoral reform and the labor movement's role in electoral reform. And those chapters, I think, are complemented by other chapters that talk about the labor politics outside the realm of parliamentary politics, like Charlotte Yates and Amanda Coles write a chapter on women, unions, and neoconservative politics. Suzanne Mills and Tyler McCreary write a chapter on union engagement with Aboriginal politics. A lot of these chapters talk about things that haven't traditionally been considered labor politics. And more than half of the contributors come from really a new generation of labor studies scholars. And so this is one of those books that we thought had to be written. The contribution from these new scholars is extremely important because it also demonstrates that there's a shift within labor studies and political science about how we think about these things.
In terms of the authors you've mentioned, I know they've been covering relevant topics. Peter Grafe and his study of Quebec, for example, he looked at the relationship between labor unions and government in Quebec and how it differs from the rest of Canada. So we want to learn more about these, and we can check that out by coming down tonight. So that's, again, the book launch for Rethinking the Politics of Labor. That's at 7 o'clock p.m. in the Workers' Arts and Heritage Center, which is at 51 Stewart Street in Hamilton. So both of you are going to be there, is that right?
Absolutely. We're going to be there, and several of the chapter contributors, particularly those who live in the Hamilton area, will be there as well. We'll talk a little bit about the book, and so will each of the chapter contributors there about their contribution and why they think that it's important, the topic is important. And there'll also be some treats and good conversation, and it's a free event. event as well. And we will, of course, have copies of the book on sale at the event. If people aren't able to come to the event, the book is available for order online directly from our publisher, Fernwood Publishing. And the website is www.fernwoodpublishing.ca. And so once you get there, you can find our book. It's the first in a series that Fernwood is publishing, the Labor in Canada series. And so there are slated to be many more volumes that are, you know, trying to grapple with the key issues that are faced by the labor movement and working class people in Canada. And so ours is the first volume, but there are many more to come.
Great. Well, this is crystal clear for our listeners, and it'll be easy for some people to get out there at 7 o'clock if they catch this now. So, well, again, thanks very much, both of you, for coming in right to the studio. Helps our listeners a lot, so I appreciate it. And I hope the book launch goes very well. I'll be there myself.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Brendan. It's great.
Great.